Friends, you're listening to Irish Radio Network USA and irishradio.com worldwide. Now we head over, indeed, to Kilkenny in Ireland and to Minister Malcolm Noonan, who is TD, member of the Irish Parliament, and he is Minister of State for Heritage and Electoral Reform. Very happy to welcome you, Minister. How are you?
Not too bad, and good morning to you and to your listeners.
Now, let me ask you about, because it is major news, but we're delighted to get you to explain it to us. UNESCO is the United Nations Education, Scientific and Cultural Organization, and I believe that it goes back to, it was created in 1945. Who are members of UNESCO, and is it roughly, is it a world organization?
It is indeed. It's a United Nations governed organization. They're based in Paris, and they're largely responsible for all of our national or international heritage sites. And to become on the World Heritage List, which we are talking about, our three sites that have put on our tentative list, is a significant achievement, and it really gives status and added protection levels to World Heritage sites. And globally, our World Heritage is under all sorts of threats from climate change. We see it with the war in Ukraine as well. And in Ireland, we have two sites currently. Those are Brú na Boina, Newgrange, and Naas in County Meath, and, of course, Skellig Michael off the coast of Kerry. So it's really exciting that we can put together, and every 10 years we revisit our tentative list of what Ireland wishes to put forward to be included in World Heritage Site status. And we're delighted to have put forward these really three important sites to be considered by UNESCO.
Now, Minister, the selection is made every 10 years by UNESCO. So is a heritage site that was designated 10 years ago, will that come off the list now, or is there is this for a lifetime? How does that work?
So what happens is, in each member state, each country that participates putting forward these lists, we draft up what we call a tentative list. So there's a panel of experts, of heritage experts in Ireland, that review this list every 10 years, and they work with local authorities and Tourism Ireland and other partners to develop what is a very expansive and exhaustive process in itself to put forward these sites. And the three sites we selected, or our selection panels brought forward, were the Neolithic Passage Tomb Landscape of County Sligo, the Transatlantic Cable Ensemble at Valentia in County Kerry, and that's a transboundary application with Canada, because this was the first transatlantic cable that went from Ireland to Canada. And then the third was what we term as the Royal Sites of Ireland, and this is Dún Áineadh in County Kildare, the Hill of Inshock in County Westmeath, Rock of Cashel, which would be very familiar to your listeners, in County Tipperary, Rathcohen in County Roscommon, and Tara in County Meath, and Navan Forth in County Armagh. So again, there's a cross-boundary element to that with Northern Ireland tourism. So it's very exciting. And then there were other sites such as Glendalough, the Burren in County Clare, that were putting themselves forward, but they're not quite ready. So we're working with them to ensure that they will go forward the next time. Yeah. So the implications of this, if these sites go forward and given consideration, and if they are accepted by UNESCO, we will be adding greatly to our World Heritage sites. So for visitors coming from the United States, from all over the world, to have World Heritage Site status on these sites gives that huge added value from a visitor point of view. They really recognize the international importance of these as cultural, archaeological, and built heritage sites.
Now, being from Mayo myself, I can't say that I ever heard of the Passage Tomb landscape of County Sligo, or maybe I did and I forgot. But what is it? Where is it? What part of Sligo is...
Well, it's in northwest Sligo, and it's a series of passage tombs, so there's a network of them, and we know that from archaeological studies that a lot of these sites are interconnected. They're interconnected on the landscape, not too dissimilar to the sites in Brunaboyne. And
right.
I think the interpretation of that interconnection is really significant. We've really, I think only in the last decade or so, they've really done a lot more research into them. And I think that's why they're really exciting to have them on the list.
Now, Passage Tomb. So it was this obviously, or let me make an educated guess, that this is underground. Were they secret passage tombs, and what was their original purpose?
The original purpose was obviously to honour the dead, and these were people of great significance and importance in Neolithic times, 5,000 years ago, and they would have probably being royalty of their day. So the passage refers to the alignment with the rising sun or setting sun. So some of them have alignment to both the summer equinox and the winter equinox. So there's that spiritual dimension to them, where particularly in the winter solstice, that the light fills up the chamber, and that is in itself a spiritual experience for the worshippers, or for those who are remembering the deceased in these that are interred in these tombs. So they're very important. There are many of them dotted all over the landscape. There's one not too far from you here in County Kilkenny, which is called Knockroe Passage Tomb,
yeah.
Which again has a winter and a summer alignment, and they're hugely significant. And it's fantastic that the Sligo Passage Tombs are included in it.
Now, if I'm looking at a picture here, a photo of the passage tomb in Sligo, and I'm just wondering if you were in that area, would you find it? It appears to me like there is a mound. It looks in the photo anyway, as if it looks like it's a huge kind of mountain. Is that rock? Is it?
They were built up in those mound formations. Again, people will be more familiar with Newgrange or Knowth, and in Brunaboyne, which have been interpreted and many ways reconstructed, but these are perhaps less visual in the sense that they are still in their raw form. And I think there's a big challenge from our perspective. Our National Monuments Service and the Office of Public Works in Ireland are tasked with the interpretation and the care of them. And I think from that point of view, we have to be mindful that, you know, with a lot of heritage sites, they don't want to be, attracting too many people to them. I think it's important that we take care of them, that it's really important that people get to see them. But so we have to address issues of accessibility, of interpretation, and to ensure that we don't damage these sites by too many visitors, or sometimes the wrong kind of visitors. And I think that's something we're mindful of with all of our heritage sites across the country.
Would most people who have visited there, is there, in line with what you're, have been saying there about visitors, are there people who, if one were traveling through Sligo, is there anything to indicate where this particular area is and where it is?
There is, and certainly Sligo Tourism have been working with the Office of Public Works to ensure that there's accessibility and visibility of them. So really, it's an emerging story, and it's a story that we're working to interpret in a greater way and develop. So but certainly people would have access to them and an ability to visit as well.
All right. So we have, so the list has been drawn, and we look forward, of course, very much to, something else to look forward to. And it definitely is going to be another addition to tourism in Ireland, which is now trying to get back on its feet, not just Ireland, but everywhere after the pandemic. I'd like to ask you about your role as a minister. This is one area. But first of all, as a senior figure in the Greens Party in Ireland, have you been active or with the Green Party the whole during your lifetime? Is this something that? How did you get started? If we go back another 30 years,
Probably that much. I mean, I started working and volunteering with environmental organizations such as Friends of the Earth in Ireland. So I was very active as an environmental and community activist. And I think around 2003, the Green Party recognized that activism and asked me to run in local elections. There's no political background in my family. So I did reluctantly and was fortunate to be elected to the city council here and the county council in Kilkenny on the first occasion. And really, it was from there that I continued through a political career. Obviously, the Greens have had ups and downs, and particularly in 2009 when we were in that government, that coalition government that had to deal with the international financial crisis, and we were effectively almost wiped out. So I think at that stage I was only one of two elected representatives that the Greens had left in the country, and our current party leader, Eamon Ryan, I contested a leadership contest with him, and thankfully Eamon won, because I certainly wouldn't know what I would have done if had I beaten him. And he has led our party since back into coalition government. I suppose 2020, the election took place in the general election took place in February of 2020. Mm. And we returned 12 TDs or members of parliament. Mm. And we were in a position then when the pandemic hit to sit down and negotiate with the parties to try and form a government to get our country through what was a huge crisis. And I'm really, really glad that we did. So I suppose it's been an interesting journey from local politics into government and fantastic for a small political party to be at the front and centre of driving policy.
Yes. Now, again, you're an equal partner in the coalition government of Ireland, Fianna Fáil, and the Greens. Recently, the whole topic of global warming, the environment, and we had not this president but the previous president said there wasn't much to that at all, and indicated maybe there was a lot of pishrog there. But let me ask you about the challenges let's just start with Ireland, and I just want to head straight for the gullet here. There seems to be a tremendous amount of angst for those who, like many of us here, grew up either on or near the bogs in Ireland, and the turf, which was very much a part of the possessions of the very popular and necessary possessions of those, particularly after the Irish famine. what is the position with, say, bogland, with some of the areas? Is Ireland subject wholly to whatever the European Union has, or is there some autonomy in each country?
Yeah, I suppose that the broader climate issue is dominating everything now, and quite so. I mean, most of Europe has been on fire with record temperatures, and you're experiencing them in the United States as well. But globally, we see the rate of climate change exacerbating, coming faster and faster, and a lot of what we would have anticipated for 40, 50, 60 years' time is here with us now. So we have to act. Globally, we've all, the countries that have signed up to the Paris Agreement, it's fantastic. President Biden brought the United States back into it upon taking office. And in Ireland, we have it's not a unique challenge. It's the same challenge many countries are facing as we transition away from fossil fuels towards decarbonisation, rapid decarbonisation, renewable energy. And I suppose the issue with the bogs, we've had a very strong cultural tie, you're absolutely right, with our bogs in Ireland. And I think people across America would, hear those stories from their relations and ancestors. They're well documented. But that relationship has changed now. And we're, our largest peat extraction company, Bord na Mona, has moved from brown to green, as they say themselves. So they've moved away from the extraction of peat to the rehabilitation of bogs. So they're currently rehabilitating 33,000 hectares of bogland, cutaway bog. They are our main contractors to my department to rehabilitate raised bogs and blanket bogs across parts of the Midlands and the West as well. And so there's a really big, exciting project happening in Ireland to rewet our bogs as carbon sinks, but also for biodiversity and to improve water quality. But it's not without its challenges, because there are still people, families who have what they call turbary rights. My mother still has a turbary right on a bog up in the Bog of Annan in Kildare. And lots of people have that, and some people want to continue doing that. And then there are contractors who cut turf commercially, but which is actually illegal now. So we've had a challenge in trying to take that, in trying to move away from that, and there's a compensation scheme there. And more recently, the government has been involved in a lot of controversy because of a smoky fuel ban, which includes turf, to try and improve air quality in urban areas. So thankfully, we're starting to address it. As I said, it's not without its challenges. And my own department is responsible for biodiversity in Ireland, so we're really keen to do it from a biodiversity perspective. So we have a lot of really big projects, particularly up around Donegal, Mayo, down into Sligo and northwest Galway, where we're rewarding landowners and farmers for the rehabilitation of upland blanket bog habitats. And it's proven to be very successful. The farmers want to be part of it. Many of them are marginal farmers anyway. And if they're getting what we call results-based payments for improving the habitat, they're getting an additional income from what would be a very generally a poor income from those type of farms. So it is going to be, as I said, challenging but very exciting as well. And there's a recognition that our peatlands in Ireland have a greater capacity for carbon sequestration than rainforests or than and they really have a huge added value in improving water quality and the value for nature as well. So it is going to be difficult, but there's lots of really exciting work going on here too.
In your role as minister, you cover a number of areas, and perhaps you would perhaps explain for our benefit, the TD role in particular areas. For instance, you have Carlow and Kilkenny. Now, are those lines, those border lines, are they subject to change, as you know, as we have over here every few years? The party in power does a little bit of a shuffle to try and see if they can redraw those lines which many would say is strictly for political purposes, either to hold on to the seats that they have, or indeed to change around to make everything less favorable or more favorable.
Yeah, so I have my portfolio. I'm in the Department of Housing, which is based in the Custom House. So my portfolio is heritage and electoral reform. The heritage portfolio deals with all of our built heritage, our national monuments, waterways, and then also natural heritage. So I'm responsible for Killarney National Park, all of our national parks, our nature reserves. And then on the electoral reform side, I've been responsible to deliver an electoral reform bill, which just concluded its passage through the legislature in two weeks ago. And that will, for the first time, establish an electoral commission in Ireland. That commission will be tasked now. We've just completed a census. And once the full census data has been completed, that will trigger the commission to begin a process of reviewing the Dáil constituencies. So and given that the population has increased by about, on average across the country, about 6-7%, that will mean that we will most likely have extra TDs in the Dáil. So currently we have 160 TDs. The commission will look at bringing that up to between 171 and 181. So my constituency, Carlow-Pakenny, is two counties, five TDs elected from it. It may have six in the next election, or it may in the next general election, or it may have three and four. So it is going to be interesting, and the commission is impartial. So unlike the United States, it's we as politicians will sit back and see what the commission recommends, and we'll have to accept that recommendation and head into the next general election based on the revised Dáil constituencies and however many seats are there. So I may have less in my constituency, which might really impinge on my chances to be re-elected, because I was really elected on the very last count, and very lucky to be elected. And so it's going to have implications, particularly for smaller parties, I think, because, you know, the Greens, Labour Party, Social Democrats, unlike the three big parties, Sinn Féin, Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael, always are playing catch-up, and will always, particularly when you go into government, you're perceived as a mudguard for the big parties, and you might take a bit of a bashing for that. So it's going to be really interesting, but the Commission is also going to do a lot of really valuable work about participation and education around our democratic system and dealing with issues of disinformation online, as you know, the United States has been no stranger to that, but all countries are starting to see it. So we're looking at trying to, you know, strengthen the robustness of our electoral process and our system, and I'm really excited about that.
Now, let me ask you, politics being pretty much what it is universally, would the fact that Ireland is now going through, not only Ireland, but, you know, right across Europe, is going through breaking new records with heat and all of the resulting, you know, negative new areas to deal with, like in forests and fires and everything. Is that going to, as you see it, will that change some of the political, the makeup of the political parties? Wasn't the Greens like an easy target, which you've pretty much told us about anyway? But what about those who, you know, who are now saying, oh, geez, there must be something to this global warming. Where denial or ignoring the reality of global warming, you know, where that might have been, you know, easy to slough off, let's say, you know, for decades. How do you think that's going to affect the political dynamic in Ireland?
That's a really interesting question. I think, I mean, we came in 2020, perhaps in a wave of green votes. You know, it was the largest vote we'd ever received, but it was still only about 7%. And yet we elected 12 TDs. Marginally, we probably could have got to 15 or 16. but it's our largest ever parliament or Dáil representation. And that was partially because of young people animated by Greta Thunberg and by the Fridays for Future. And they were urging their parents to vote Green because they were fearful of what was happening with climate change. But I think the Greens could take a significant, in Ireland, could take a very significant bashing by the electorate because a lot of the Green policies are not very popular. They're perceived as being costly. We have an energy crisis caused partially by the war in Ukraine, but other reasons as well. You know, there's a very risk in Europe of blackouts. We've had to buy in extra energy infrastructure. Our emissions have actually gone up last year rather than go down. So the narrative might be that what is the point of having the Greens there? Because the emissions are going up. We're having our energy costs are going up. Fuel is going up. And we're not seeing any benefits from voting Green. So people or the electorate can be impatient. And as we transition away from fossil fuels towards offshore wind, which we have an abundance of around the coast of Ireland, that's going to take a bit of time. So I think that's reflective of what might happen in other countries where certainly the Greens are doing very well in other European countries, not so well in Britain, but that's a first past the post system. And so it's going to create a very interesting dynamic. And people, as temperatures rise, people's temperatures will rise as well because they're feeling, there'll be large parts of the world where in the next 20, 30 years will become uninhabitable. So the reality that we're facing is a lot of disruption and a lot of migration up north away from these hotter climates. So I suppose if that's a broad answer to your question, it will have a very strong political implication as well. And in Ireland too, we're certainly conscious of that in the Green Party, that to try and keep our message out there and strong is, I find, hugely challenging right now.
Well, you're doing your bit, and I think also with all of the other impacts of, particularly now, we can see, you know, how a war, which we used to assume was in the past tense, you know, can disrupt not only Europe, but the entire world, the economy, not to mention all the, the personal loss and grief that comes with that. But it would be, it would be hard to single out any country at this stage of the game with respect to, again, the cost, the energy costs. But I do want to ask you, though, is Ireland considered to be any better or any worse, if you were to go across Europe in terms of, the enormous cost factors that comes along with the recent escalation, in the cost of energy?
I think we'd probably stand up pretty well. I think what we've tried to do since the war started is to put in place measures, both a blunt instrument of a rebate to every household in the country, every household bill, to very targeted measures on low-income households around to address fuel poverty. And that's the fuel allowance, and that's the mechanism by which we do that. And so we've increased that very significantly by about 53%. Furthermore, then, we have a public service obligation levy on ESP bills, electricity bills here, and that will go into negative territory by October. So, again, householders will receive a further rebate. And then the third element of what we're trying to do around the energy side is to fast-track the retrofit, deep and shallow retrofit, of our housing stock. Much of our housing stock here is of really poor quality, and particularly in rural areas outside of the Greater Dublin area. We have a housing stock, a social housing stock, but also private housing stock that requires significant retrofit. So we're giving very generous grants and then supporting local authorities to carry out retrofits of their stock as well. So I think all of these combined measures will help. But again, they take time. do we have enough apprentices, enough people to work to actually carry out the work? We don't, so we're trying to address that. We almost have a perfect storm of challenges where in an economy that is in full employment now, to do all the stuff we want to do for biodiversity, for climate, for retrofit, for this transition we have to make, we don't have the labour force to do it. And, you know, so that's a huge challenge. Added to that, then, we've taken in up to about 42,000 Ukrainian refugees, and we have internationally displaced people who are coming here in larger numbers because of the decision of the UK government to partner with Rwanda in dealing with their intake of refugees. So all of these challenges combined for a government are really significant. And you know, there is a resolve there to try and get through them. And, you know, to a large extent, the Irish people are, you know, they're supportive, they understand and they appreciate how difficult it is. But, you know, we're not underestimating what is going to be a very, very difficult winter ahead for everybody.
In the meantime, though, you're not short of Yanks going to Ireland because, again, the influx and the exodus from North America of those who have been waiting for a couple of years to get back to Ireland, that's in full swing. And we know that those who were heading for Ireland, particularly in the last couple of weeks, you know, and if they didn't get any current information, maybe bringing some autumn, fall close with them, they got a good land with the heat wave in Ireland. It's great. Tourism coming back, obviously. And I want to thank you for spending, you know, the time with us. And we're indeed delighted, you know, with the news. And again, you know, you have spent a big chunk of your life indeed involved with what for you must be very rewarding at this stage of the game to now see the electoral process of having three new sites, UNESCO sites in Ireland. Good luck to you at that one.
Thank you very much, and I agree, it's fantastic to have visitors back here in Kilkenny. We have a very strong tourism sector, and to see all the coaches lined along the Castle Road near Kilkenny Castle again, and overflowing into an overflow car park, is just fantastic to see it, and the restaurants and the bars thriving again with the music, and it's something we missed so greatly. So we really do value our American visitors, and. You know, there's no doubt it's challenging, but it's very rewarding too to be in government right now and try to address these challenges on behalf of the people.
Well, good luck to you, and in particular, I think to the Irish government too, because it has been an extremely difficult time, seeing at every twist and turn, and that's not unique to Ireland, but it would appear that. The generosity of Ireland in terms of taking, you know, some 42,000 Ukrainian refugees at a time, you know, when there were so many other issues with housing and with everything else, speaks well, not only for, you know, the current generation and the current government, but also, you know, it isn't from the wind we took it. Somehow that's been very much part of our heritage.
That's absolutely true. And it's something, you know, it's not too far down back the generations when all of us are, you know, have family members who have had to emigrate. And I think that has stood us well, because it means, you know, as a nation, we're incredibly welcoming, and, you know, we don't see much dissent at all towards this. Everybody wants this to happen. We know it's difficult to do it, but we all know our shared history is one of huge suffering and in many ways, and of immigration, Irish people scattered all around the world, no more so than in the United States. And I think that's something that we value when people come here, and that's why the generosity of spirit that exists here. And again, we're so grateful to the people of Ireland for the warm welcome that they've shown these people fleeing a terrible, terrible conflict.
How right you are. Minister Malcolm Noonan, again, coming to us live from Kilkenny in Ireland. And Minister, again, good luck to all of what you and everybody in Ireland appears to be, pulling together, doing the best they can under very, very challenging circumstances. Thank you again, and you know where we are if you're coming our way, and I think a lot of people for the Kilkenny and Carlow area, very popular spots indeed for visitors. Thank you. Okay.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Lovely to talk to you.
And friends, you're listening to Irish Radio Network USA, irishradio.com.